You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
So let me briefly introduce Allison to those of you who don't have the good fortune of already knowing her. So Allison, for the past 4 years, has been working on a project called Project Information Literacy. I suspect most of us are in favor of information literacy, so that's already a good thing. The project has interviewed 11,000 students, surveyed 11,000 students around the country, trying to get at what it's like to be a student in the age of the digital. Allison, as if you don't already know, and as you will hear today, is a wonderful researcher. She loves data. She loves methodology, and comes to us from the University of Washington Information Sciences Science Group. So, Allison,
thank you very much, David. Can you hear me? Okay, good, because I do have a microphone on. If you can't, let me know. They can adjust that. Thank you for coming today. And I kind of say that with a smile because when, about a month ago, Amar over at the Berkman had a running list of who had signed up. I think the announcement had been up maybe a week. And I went to Amar and I said, did anybody sign up? And he said, oh, we just have two names. And I said, who? And he said, Sue Gilroy. Some of you may know, works in Lamont. She's also on our board of directors for PIL. So I said, okay, well, I'm having dinner with her tonight. I'll thank her. And I said, who's the other person? I probably don't know him. I said, Lana Jackman. I said, it's over here, who is one of the co-directors of the National Forum on Information Literacy. And he said, do you know her? And I said, I'm having dinner with her tomorrow night. So you helped me save face in an important way because there's some of you I actually don't know. So what I want to talk to you about today is Project Information Literacy, which David was talking about, which is an ongoing national study, funding, God willing, but so far we've been able to make it through 4 years as a national study. So before I get started, however, usually at the Berkman, people go around and introduce themselves. That would probably take all the time up, and I wouldn't be able to present. So let's get a show of hands so we have an idea of who you're sitting next to by profession. How many of you are librarians? Okay, I knew there were a lot of you from looking at the Google list. Okay. How many of you are faculty? Okay. And how many of you are directors or administrators of some sort, of a program or a center? Okay. Students? Good. So a good representation. Anybody I forgot? Just somebody interested who doesn't want to say? Nothing. Okay, good. Well, I know who you are, and we have a good idea of who's sitting in the room. As David mentioned, we've actually interviewed and surveyed over 11,000 students in the last 4 years. We tend to do projects. I think what's unique about Project Information Literacy is that a couple of things. It's a study across institutions. We tend to like very large samples and see if we can get them. Harvard's been in 3 of our studies out of 5. And we did a large-scale survey, probably our biggest effort here, actually, was in 2010, of students, to find out how they found information, how they used information, as well as the difficulties with information. We tend to use survey research, interviews, but we have used content analysis before, too. Those of you who like to get in the weeds, we are an exempt project through Human Subjects. We do educational research as characterized by our methods. And also, we don't use random samples. We use voluntary samples. So this may affect some of the things you're hearing. However, at the same time, this is my disclaimer, at the same time, We don't say that our findings are necessarily generalizable to all students everywhere, because if you know anything about statistics, we don't have the numbers to be able to say that. So what we tend to look at is the relationships between different kinds of schools and overall trends in the sample itself. Something else that's a little bit unusual about this study is we make every effort to include community colleges, which are often underrepresented in research studies like this of students in college. But of course, we know a lot of students are being educated in community colleges. It's a very important place to understand. One of the reasons that community colleges tend to be avoided, just as kind of a footnote, is that they really don't have IRB or human subjects. So the review process to get permission is lengthy. It's often difficult. Sometimes you can end up at the president's desk of a community college. Sometimes it's a librarian and such. But we always try to represent community colleges, as well as public four-year colleges and universities, and four-year private colleges and universities. So this is an overview, and I'm going to try to talk about some of these different studies. The other thing that's unique is we've looked at research not with tests. A number of research about information literacy has tested students on their skills and their competencies. We decided we wanted to do something different. I lead the project with Mike Eisenberg, who's written a lot in the field, came up with the Big Six model many years ago, and we got together and started talking about what was missing from the equation. And what we decided was you really didn't have an idea of what went through students' heads when they were doing research. So we've characterized our research as looking at information literacy through the lens of the student experience. What's it like to be a student in the digital age? Or more specifically, as information scientists, we've looked at how do students define the research process? How do they conceptualize it and think of it? Both course-related research and everyday life research. What we mean, there actually is a thread of research called everyday life research. And what it looks at are the research questions that somebody has from day to day. Sometimes it's personal curiosity, but sometimes it's health issues, purchasing issues and such, especially for students. These seem to be top areas for them. So that gives you an overview. We've looked at course-related research, as I said, everyday life research. We've looked across institutions to look at trends of how students are not only defining the research process today, but also the steps they take from finding to using to applying, as well as the difficulties. So my challenge today is to take five studies, and I think we probably have, or if you read our research reports, they tend to be long, and they tend to be detailed, but librarians that we work with tell us they want that detail, and that helps them understand their students in their setting better and think about things perhaps differently. So if I look across the study, I would say there are four key takeaways that Mike and I keep coming back to that are really central to all the PIL studies. I've never done this, so it's, you know, it's a first time here. Usually I talk about one particular study, but this time I'm going to try to talk about all the studies and see if I can do it in 30 to 40 minutes. I know now somebody will time me. Okay, so the first takeaway. This came from our first focus group that we did in 2008, a series of focus groups at six different institutions. Harvard was in the sample, as well as the University of Illinois and two community colleges, University of Washington. And what we found overall was that students said, consistently we heard, students kept saying, the research project process is more difficult than it's ever been before. Not necessarily for them because they were in college, but more overall, research has gotten very, very difficult. Course-related research, everyday life research. Now, when we published this in our first report, We highlighted it. We had it in bold. And then several librarians, not from here, but librarians from very top universities wrote and said, how could that be true? We have all this information we give them. We have databases. I mean, the library's open 24/7. Who did you have in your focus groups? This is crazy. You have no idea what you're doing. So this became a really guiding force for us as we went through the process. The more we talked to students, and this comes from the focus group, the more we talked from students, we heard a number of different adjectives about course-related research, also about everyday life research, too, that really pointed to the fact that research is a stressful process for students. These are actual adjectives that students used in the discussion groups that we had back in 2008. This led us, in thinking about this, this led us to think about a preliminary model. We always call it a preliminary model. We're always working on it. We're always redefining it. And the preliminary model really talks about how the frustrations are grounded in the research process, why is research frustrating, and also how do students conceptualize the research process. And what we found is that very beginning part of research, which we measured actually in a survey that came later, was a time where students tried to define four different contexts. These are the four contexts we heard over and over again that students talked about. There may be more. We don't know. But we're always looking at these four contexts, and we measure them with the notion that we may expand this model. But this is our preliminary model of the research process. Now, if you follow the literature, you know that Carol Kolthow has written about kind of the emotional, the uncertainty of conducting research. This is related, but it's a little bit different, because what we found was students needed context to conduct course-related and everyday life research. And this was incredibly time-consuming, laborious, yet essential. And students couldn't do an assignment. They couldn't find out, for instance, some solution that had risk associated with it for everyday life research. Let me give you an example. You might think of everyday life research as being, well, what's playing at a jazz club down the block? What movies are on? Where can I live? But what we found was that everyday life research, this came up quite a bit, everyday life research often had a lot of risk associated with it. And something, when we were doing the focus groups, several students kept mentioning medical problems, and in particular, it must have been a year where there was a real run on Lyme disease. But Lyme disease was a good example here, because you realize the risk. If you don't find out the right information, you could end up with a horrible disease that you could have for the rest of your life. So let me briefly talk about these different contexts. The way that they fit in is they define meaning. And they're necessary for interpretation for students as they unlock the puzzle of trying to find information. And this is what students said they had a lot of trouble with, they had a lot of frustrations with, but they knew they needed to get these different kinds of contexts to move forward. The first one is big picture context. This comes up more often than anything else. We've also measured in a survey that came afterwards that this occurs at the very beginning of the process, which makes sense, because you need to know what you're searching for. A student talked, for instance, about having a paper. This is a great one. I love this one. In the focus groups, and he said, I went to class, and there was an assignment on, this really reminds you of college, there was an assignment on Socrates, but not what Socrates thought 2,500 years ago, how Socrates would be relevant to a problem today. And this was in an international relations class. And he said, I looked at the syllabus and I thought, was this covered? Socrates? Then and now? Oh, God. What was his... What I need to do is to find out what he said, his central idea. It's a little bit difficult to do with Socrates, if you know anything about Socrates. So big picture actually allowed students to delineate a topic and get their arms around it. Another student talked about, I just got an assignment for dictatorships in the Southern Cone. When? You know, is this recent? Is this another, like, the Socrates assignment? What are we talking about? What time period? So we'll come back to big picture context a little bit later in the presentation, because I want to talk to you about where students go to get that context and what we found there. The second context is information gathering context. Now, this is an interesting one, especially for librarians, because information gathering context has to do with where you find the information you need and how you access it. Now, if you're on a campus like this one at Harvard, you would say, that's a real problem, because you could go to 70 libraries or so and maybe get information that would be relevant. But say you're on a small campus. This is how it's changed. I was talking to, emailing with Barbara Pfister last week about something unrelated, actually, who has a column for Inside Higher Ed and Library Journal. And I said, you know, you're at Gustavus Adolphus, the small liberal arts college. What's information gathering context there? You know, I'm giving this presentation at Harvard. And she said, here's the quick answer. We give students access to 80 databases here at our small library, and what they really want is one. Make it easy. So information gathering context has been heightened. It's much more difficult now. Then language context. I'll jump ahead a little bit. Out of these contexts, it wasn't information gathering that students were more likely to go to a librarian in our sample. Actually, it was for language context. The meaning of words so that search terms could be developed. Another important key here. And then situational context. Lots of discussion about situational context, which the long and short definition, it's the expectations. Now, if you're in course-related research, this is huge, because the expectations are, how long does a paper have to be? How do I get an A? How do I pass? You know, it could be formulaic. It could also be back to the Socrates. What does this professor expect? Where situational in everyday life could be, how far do I go with an answer? Can I self-diagnose and find out I don't have Lyme disease? Or have I not gone far enough? Have I not found the answer? So these different contexts are really based on what students told us. It's not a model that I came up with, you know, in my office one day. It's really based on what we heard from students when they talked about difficulties in the beginning process, when they used those adjectives. So I've covered some of these things, but I wanted to show you what we did in 2010 is we did, actually it was 2009, excuse me, and then 2010 we did something else, but it's related. But in 2009, we looked at each one of these contexts and in a survey asked, do you have this need, this contextual need? Had a question about that. They all existed in the sample. Sample's about 6 schools, and it's about 2,300 students. The other thing we found is, at different times, how often do you have this need? Big picture's the biggest one, no surprises there. Information gathering came in too, that students had this need for course-related research often. Now, if you're somebody that cares about how students find information, this is a pretty interesting finding, because it shows they're really having trouble traversing the landscape, whether they come to librarians or not, or whether they go to instructors. And then language came up sometimes. As I said before, and I'll fit this in here, we did what's called a logistic regression on these results and the context, and found, along with librarians, and found that students were 1.5, 1.5 times more likely to go to a librarian for language. You think it would be information gathering. It's not. It's for language context. And then lastly, situational came up sometimes. Sometimes a little bit later in the process, not right at the beginning. Everyday life research, what's interesting, I think, about this is these contexts are the same as we've defined them in the model. However, big picture context still comes up a lot. And then the other categories come up sometimes. So those of us, we often have these preconceptions about students. And those of us that think, oh, everyday life research, it's, you know, it's going to be where, you know, to get some new tennis shoes, or it's going to be where to get, you know, the latest, you know, the latest music that's come out. But actually, this shows, and I think the implications are, we wrote a First Monday piece about this last year, that everyday life research is important to students. And in fact, one student said, and a number of students said, it's so much harder than course-related research because it's open-ended. And the only way you can really find out if you're right, think Lyme disease, think about whether you're pregnant or not, think about whether you'll get a job. The only way that you can really find out is to go test it in the world. With course-related research, actually, you get a grade, and then it's over, and it's finite, and you move on. That's an interesting juxtaposition, I think. So the second takeaway here is that this is where it gets interesting. If you look at these needs for context, and you also look at the beginning of the research process, where do students turn for information? And what we found, and I think this takeaway is actually brought up a lot about our research, is that students, as I wrote, students turn to the same tried and true resources. They're creatures of habit. You've got a whole bunch of resources here, undergrads, the students in our sample, I'll be careful how I phrase that, we're not using most of these resources. Let's look a little bit closer. Course readings was number one. Now, I've got two bars here. One's gray. Where's Sue? Oh, she knows I'm colorblind. And one's green. Okay, sorry. It's a real drawback. My husband's not with me. Usually he can help me with color. So the top one is 2010, our survey results. And the bottom one's 2009. And really what this chart is about is, what resources do you use for course-related research? However, in 2009, in Truth in Advertising, it was a slightly different question. It was, how do you fill the context, the contextual needs that you have? I've just compared them here because what I think is interesting, in 2002, we said, where do you start research? In 2009, since we were... And I have a backup glass, too. In 2010, we asked, where do you start the research process? In 2009, we said, when you have one of these needs, big picture, language, information gathering, and situational, where do you go? In 2009, we found students went to the same sources no matter what contextual need they had. That's interesting. And then when we asked in the following year, the gray bar, students began the research process using the same sources. So overall, what you can say and what the implications are is, A, students aren't using a lot of sources that are on campuses, at least the students that we studied. B, their preference from sample to sample is still the same. These are the most frequently consulted. It's a whole long list if you look at the reports, which are online, on projectinfolit.org. But course readings came in number one. Now, people have asked me about course readings and said, course readings? Why was that? Why didn't you just start with Google? That's what everybody wants to know. It's what everybody assumes. And we thought course readings were really interesting because I was a professor for 20 years, and something it solved a problem I found occurring in the classroom, which was that if you critiqued the course readings, it made students really upset. It was like, what? What do you care? I mean, oh, you had to pay for the book. But and then even if it was free, it was like, please don't critique this reading. It's like, why? I mean, you know, professors never find the best readings for a course. I never could. You know, it was like, oh, I can put this in, but it's really not the thread that I'm going, you know, throughout the class. And what we found was that course readings are a place that students go to, not only to get situational context, kind of using some of our model terms here, but also to define big picture context and get the lay of the land. And they really don't want you ripping on the findings, because then that kind of really raises some problems with situational context of, well, but you said this, that this reading was really the way it was, that this was, it sounds like high school, but a lot of these students think this way, this was where the answers were. You lectured on it. And now you're going to say, as I often say about readings, they really need a good editor. And it's too long. Somebody should say that about my reports. But I guess when you're writing it, you always go long. So course readings came in first. The other thing I think this speaks to is students are smart. They have a way of approaching an assignment to gratify the professor, to keep the professor satisfied. If I use the course readings as research material, not only are they convenient and close at hand, but they were sanctioned by the professor. So they must apply here. Then we get into Google library databases. Instructors. You don't see librarians here. This was a long chart. Librarians are towards the bottom. This isn't news. OCLC has found this. Ariel has found this in the Illinois study that came out earlier this year. But what's interesting is instructors are a go-to source for students. They have the sanction of the grade. They did, after all, assign the paper or the research assignment, whatever it might be. But students don't think of going to librarians for filling these different contexts. The other thing that I think is interesting about this chart is that kind of dispels some of the ways we think about students, or kind of the conventional wisdom that all students go online for everything. They're not. We found in the study we did in 2010 that for evaluation, a lot of times students would talk to friends, they'd talk to a roommate, they'd talk to instructors, they'd talk to somebody, a parent, somebody that they respected. So what we've suggested is really the search process is more of a hybrid model, including people and online sources, just not librarians as much as probably librarians would like to see themselves up here, as you would expect. And then Wikipedia. Now, I am going to talk about Wikipedia in just a short bit, but Wikipedia, of course, is the ultimate big picture context site. Everyday life research. Where did students go when they had an everyday life research question? Most went to the web, which I think we all know. But they did go to friends and family. So again, that hybrid model carries over to everyday life research too. Sometimes people say government sites. Usually it was, often when we do the surveys, it's in May, April or May, and sometimes students are looking for jobs or they have a particular assignment. But it is funny that it's on this list from year to year. One thing I did want to point out, Wikipedia use was up in our 2010 study. Different sample, though. Different people. Here's something I think that speaks well to this same trodden course over and over again. It's mostly the same steps for me. Student talking about course-related research. It's mostly the same steps for me. If you do it right, as a rote process, if you do it right, the internet's good. It's not like back in the day when your first step was going to the library and going through books. You don't have to do that anymore. This leads us in our third takeaway to say students really do have a model of predictability and efficiency. Now, this really kind of counters some of the ideas about students being risky and looking anywhere for information. Actually, you may not approve of their research process, but it's pretty defined. They really do have a strategy. If there's anything you can take from today, yes, students have a strategy. And this is one that's built on predictability and efficiency. On one hand, it's a way to fulfill the context. On the other hand, it's a way to deal with all the information that's out there. So I bring Jessica with me today, who doesn't really exist. She's my hypothetical student. And Jessica gives us a view of, I'm going to go deep now into course-related research, because I imagine a lot of you are interested in that. With Jessica, she really doesn't have a shortage of ideas in the beginning. She has ideas, she comes up with things, she might be anxious when she first gets the research assignment, but if you talk to students, they'll say, I came up with something really cool. One student in a community college was saying, I came up with a great topic for a paper. I wanted to write about how animals really help people. And I typed it in and I didn't get any results. And she said, and then I typed, animals, psychology, and help. There you have it. She ended up getting dolphin-assisted therapy. She said, I'm not interested in dolphins. Horse-assisted therapy. And she said, no, humans and help. And she ended up getting psychotherapy and said, oh, I've gone too far the other way here. I need to back up a little bit. And she ended up getting animal-assisted therapy. And she said, now I have it. Often what happens then is she needed that language to be able to continue the process. And what if you talk to students down the way farther, often what they say is, it's an interesting fear. I hope I haven't chosen a topic that fails me. Not the class. It's more in the search for information. I'll come up short. And I'm going to go back to the course handout. And the professor said 10 sources. I can tie in the course readings. It's really not a source, but I could. I could stretch it. I can't say I went to Wikipedia. What else can I put here? So often, students are excited about research once they get over the fear of the assignment. One frustration we heard over and over again, and it's in one of the short videos that we've made that are up on the PIL site, a student said, I'm always looking and looking for a certain source, and it doesn't exist. So if you work with students, you know this well, and then they say, so I settle for second best. It will get me through the assignment, and the learning process starts to change there. From deep learning and understanding research as a mutable process to satisficing, to quote Herb Simon, finishing the assignment, getting a good grade, passing the course, and moving along, which are some of the constraints. Keeping the professor happy, getting a good grade, being able to go to work. We find a lot of students have two or three jobs. Maybe it's even parents who say, you're getting out of this school in 4 years, and you're going to pass because the tuition is outrageous. You know, and then your father and I are going to have a life. And you will go out and you will get a job, so choose a good major. Accounting, engineering, something like that, but none of this humanities stuff. Please, how are you going to get a job? So students, for a number of different reasons, are risk averse. It's not how we often think of students. They're risk averse and they play it safe. And instead of going to all the information that's available to them online, through different sources, or in a rich environment like this place, they tend to go back to what they've used before. And if you doubt me, here's one of my favorite stories where a student, even the students were shocked in the focus group, where a student said, you know, I always use Project Muse. And a student said, but there's a science course here. I mean, the student actually took on somebody in the focus group. How the hell did you get through science? And she said, well, the assignment was about breast cancer. So I did a search in Project Muse, and I found out about the metaphor of breast cancer. And that was my paper, and I got an A. But Project Muse is my resource. And that's what I know, down to the interface and how the page is laid out, to knowing it won't give me everything, but it's familiar ground. Students, for the most part, and this could totally be unpacked, and I won't, but it's so interesting to me, they tend to be self-taught and independent. If you ask students, how'd you learn how to do course-related research? Not in those terms, of course. But how'd you learn how to do this? Sometimes they will mention that first experience with a librarian in college that shows them the database was really important. Do they go back? No. They figure that they've learned the databases. Do they recognize there may be new databases? No. Or that the interface had changed? Not really. The other thing that you have running through this, which as a professor I found so fascinating to me, was that students are applying the high school model in college. Now, if you're at, I'll use my own institution. I went to Berkeley, undergrad, also doctoral. Big public, huge public. 40,000 students, 35,000 students, big public institution. Do professors really track you during the research process? And a number of students said, you know, it's not like high school. It's not like the professors care. They have no idea how I'm doing the research. I just need to fulfill the assignment. It's an order, in other words, an order that you're tallying up, like checking out of a store. Now, if you care about research and you care about inquiry, this is very different and not the way that you want critical inquiry to be done. That inquiry is more of a mutable process. It's coming back to things. It's questioning things and digging. In fact, if you're a librarian, even if you're a faculty member, it's probably why you were drawn to the field. So students tend to be self-taught and independent often and try to port over what they learned in high school to the college experience. Now, the limitation of high school, of course, is that high school works for high school. As we know, the cognitive development changes over time. And this is a very frustrating thing. I even remember in college sometimes when you'll go to a professor and say, but what's the answer? Or even, you know, at Berkeley, getting up my nerve and going to a professor's office hour and say, but you wrote this. Wasn't this the answer? Tell me the answer. You know, kind of looking to see if anybody is out there, see if you could corner them somewhere and say, but what was the answer? What was the point? And then, you know, very Berkeley, there is no answer. The answer is up to you. It seemed kind of philosophical and heavy, and you thought, no, they're kind of a ringer. They're never going to get tenure. They don't even know what they've written. Then you'd try another professor. And through 4 years, I learned research was something entirely different. It wasn't about the answer. Even when we asked students about, in 2010, at the end of the survey, we said, okay, you go through the whole course-related research process. What's important to you? What matters? What matters most, of course, is passing the course, getting a good grade, finishing the assignments. But number fourth was learning something new. And that was 76% of the sample. Also, 74%, I think, said conducting comprehensive research. You know, really getting out there. So some of these things don't jive. Perfectly. But on that list also, coming back to the answer, was I think over two-thirds said, finding the answer to prove I've done the work. And a number of students said, you could select all, any that applied. A number of students checked that and said, yes, that's me. Now, Jessica, the last thing, and I added this on yesterday, currency matters as far as evaluation. I've written this in First Monday articles that students tend to be hyper-aware of currency. So something, this makes your job difficult as a faculty member, as a professor, and as a student, actually, who's looking for information. Because the expectation is, if it's a month old or 2 months old, it may be too old, depending on what your discipline is. Not the Socrates question, although part of the Socrates question. So this often comes in number one for everyday life research as well as course-related research when students evaluate sources. But what we found is students at a number of different institutions said they really had a kind of had a wary eye. They were wary about the quality of information, even library information, often saying that they would apply 3 or 4 different standards. Sometimes these standards are things that are self-taught, the design of a page. Students tend to be very, very sensitive to the design of a website page, especially if they go out. So there's a mixture there. Still, given this practice, given honing down the research process to a number, just a few, the Project Muse student in the focus group, research is still difficult to students. This is something that we asked in our 2010 study that we had wanted to all along across 25 U.S. campuses. And number one was 84%, and that was getting started. Getting started on the research process. Really, we took these three things and defined them. It's just coincidental when we did a scale that they came in as the top three problems as task definition. So task definition, whether you're getting started, maybe overcoming procrastination, it's not something we're ignoring here, as well as defining what your topic's going to be and narrowing it down given the complexity of the information landscape, were the most difficult parts of the research. Now, I tested a number of librarians, including my co-director, I believe, over the summer when I found out these results, and said, what's the most difficult process of research? We had 20 variables for course-related research, and then we created a scale. If you look at the study, you can find out more. There was task definition, there was search, there was using information, synthesizing, sorting through information, applying it, and then there was self-assessment. So actually, Mike was kind. I took his Big Six model and made it the Big Four for purposes of our study. And what we found was task definition was the most difficult part of course-related research. A number of librarians said, it's search. It's always search, isn't it? I thought that was interesting. It's not always search. With everyday life research, I don't have a slide to talk to this because I wanted to talk about course-related research, but in case you're wondering, it was the end of the process, self-assessment. Have I really found the answer? Have I gone far enough? Have I gotten everything here? So where do students go when they're having difficulty? As we know, instructors, as one student said, they are the source. They are the research coaches. When we did an analysis of handouts that professors used in classes describing research assignments, in other words, assigning the task of a research-based paper, it was an interesting study. This is the content analysis study and well worth reading. Reputedly Mike's favorite study that we've ever conducted. And actually, I find it pretty interesting, too. Since students turn to instructors, how helpful are these handouts that students get when they have a research assignment? Now, if you're thinking, well, but professors do so much more, what you find is when you ask students, which we had done in an earlier survey, where do you go when you need help, instructors, and what's the best kind of help they can give you? Most students, number one, was email access. Then I can go through the process and ask as I go along. Number two was, give me a handout. Then I can take it with me, and I can check it off. And say, see, it would provide situational context. It would get me on my way. When we looked at these handouts, actually, 191 handouts, it's actually our biggest sample ever, 28 different U.S. institutions across disciplines, not just in humanities or social science, undergrad, not graduate school, we found out that few of the handouts really told students what research was. And I'm not looking for a philosophical diatribe about what the research process is, but even a sentence or two. There was one handout from a community college in upstate New York, and it had just a sentence or two and said, think of yourself as a detective. You're Sherlock Holmes. And you're going to go out and you're going to put together different evidence, but you have to keep collecting. And then you'll find out some of your evidence doesn't fit together and you'll have to get rid of it. Or maybe you won't use it. We contacted this professor, actually, and asked for permission to use this, and he about fell over. And said, me? I mean, I just kind of did that study because I thought it was a lark. And I said, can we use it in the study? Do we have your permission? And he said, sure. And he said, you're going to put my name there? I'm really proud of the work I've done. I said, well, this kind of raises issues with human subjects, but no, we're not. But we'll bring you up often in presentations. The other thing, if you think about context here, the other thing that was occurring is where research handouts fell short was information gathering context. They didn't provide much information gathering context to students. In other words, they didn't suggest to use librarians. Only 14% did. Go talk to a librarian. When we interviewed faculty, a number of faculty said, shouldn't they have the skill to begin with? I mean, I'm trying to cover curriculum here. I mean, they got into this institution. Shouldn't they know how to do research? In fact, we have a heading in the study I was looking at it this morning that says, no assumptions. Where professors, you read those quotes, and it's pretty damning about students of, I have no assumptions. These students really know nothing about research. But that's somebody else's job. That's, you know, they should know this by the time they get to my class. Where if you're a student, this is, the research process is something with inherent risk. Because I've heard students talk about this a lot. I got an A paper in this class, I must have done it right. How is it transferable to next semester or next quarter? And is it? So they're looking again for some sort of solution that they can apply as a strategy. And as we know, every assignment's a little bit different. And everybody's expectations a little bit different that are teaching a class. So the information gathering context really was light in these handouts. Databases, scholarly research databases, JSTOR, ProQuest. The list was so short, only 15% of the handouts mentioned databases to even start with. It wasn't just librarians, it was databases, as far as you might try this. Where the majority, 60% of this sample sent 28 different schools, students, was to the library for a book, a certain book, a place-based, finite, single-source book. And if you've ever been in, say, the class is this size, all of a sudden, somebody's going to, as soon as they hear that, think, sorry, I've got to go. I need to use the restroom. And they're going to run over to the library, and they are going to get that book. And so there's going to be a mad rush. This seems like incredibly outdated to us, that I guess a student could buy it. They won't, by the way. They expect sources to be findable, free, and full text, which is one of my future slides here. It comes up again if you like that. The other thing the handouts were weak on was plagiarism. Huge concern in institutions, every institution. How has plagiarism changed? What's going on with plagiarism? Plagiarism was mentioned in 18% of the handouts. However, it was couched in terms of punishment. You will flunk if you plagiarize. Oh, I'm not going to tell you what it is. Or go to this link and read it. Because this is the school's policy on plagiarism. P.S. You will flunk if you want to read that. Library resources. Again, how much did students use this during the research process? This comes from 2009. And what we found was you can cut this chart in half about right here. And what you find is students tend to use libraries for resources. That's good news. Library databases are right up there at the top. I think ProQuest funded this research. They loved it. It was like magic. It just kind of came in number one, and it really did. Students find that that's how they can find credible information. When we asked what motivates you to use databases, as well as currency to a certain degree, as well as satisfying the professor, because I have to have X amount of resources, which the handouts tended to weight heavily. The handouts had more formulaic steps to the research process. Libraries themselves, ask a librarian was lowest. It's consistently come in lowest on our studies. Even the little study I started at 2007 at St. Mary's College, it came in the lowest. It's interesting because you think, well, students would love this. It's a librarian wherever they're located. Maybe not true. Here's something that we did, and you can look at, I'm almost done here, but it's an interesting point, and I had to include it. Cornell had on their library page, here are the steps to the research process. And these are the steps you should take when you have an assignment. And if you look at those steps, which we compared to the steps that we found that students took, they're very different. There's something lost in translation. Now, librarians emphasize scholarly thoroughness and a way of getting at information that unpacks it using the resources and starting with credible authoritative resources in the beginning. Things like the OPAC, things like periodical indexes, things like WorldCat, and unpacks the process. Step 5 in Cornell's list says, okay, you've done all these steps. Go out and do a Google search if you want and see what you find and what you can bring to the process. As we know from the earlier chart, students often start with course readings and then Google. Most of them do. So students tend to load up heavily on sources as they're trying to define the process. It's an entirely different process here. Okay. I want to show you this very briefly, and then I will... Oops. Wikipedia. This says it better than... Can you come up and give me a full screen?
Sounds so bad, but the first place I go for information is Wikipedia.
But I've had professors say you may not go to Wikipedia.
But I do anyways. Non-cited, of course.
Me too. I don't care if it's peer-reviewed or not. I just want to figure something out that I know nothing about. I mean, nothing.
Give me what's what. I gotta know what it is before I can go ask someone else about it, or to find out about it. It just makes sense.
Wikipedia is awesome. It's got good English, no fluff, it's written like I can understand it. Gives me links to other stuff too. Takes me to the real stuff I need.
Sometimes when I get to the serious research, I think back and say, I thought Wikipedia said this though, but this source is disclaiming it here. That's when it gets interesting for me.
Yep, not that Wikipedia gives any real surefire evidence. Just makes me feel more comfortable, confident, ready to go on. Wikipedia is my first go-to place, but certainly not my last.
I'm going to end it there, actually. Anyway, Wikipedia. As one student said, it's my pre-search tool. I'm not really serious yet, or as another student said, it's my 0.05 step in the research process. It's not real research, but it sure makes me feel a lot more confident and secure. The last takeaway here. A lot of times people listen to presentations that we make and say, but how's this really different than when I was in college? How have things changed? And what we've found is, I give you 4 points here of how things have changed. First of all, students contend with, we all do, staggering amounts of information and trying to work within that environment and not using librarians who are readily accessible to help with that process. There's a problem there. Connectivity. Students are always on, always being notified. We just did a study, actually. Results came out in October, where a number of students said it's 2 weeks before finals week. They're in the library, and they're using the library setting to dial down the technology that they have in their lives. And in fact, so much so that some of the students went to the library just to use the library's computers, not with the stuff that would distract them at home. Facebook, games, things like that. I think this is a significant change, which is Web 2.0 as a culture. It used to be, when I was first teaching, you had to do the dreaded group project. And what you found, I mean, I've taught for over 20 years, students really didn't want to share, and they really didn't want to work together, and they really felt like they knew the answer. I think this has changed to a big degree with Web 2.0, the use of online forums, things like YouTube videos, Khan's Academy and such, that you can go out and work with other people and share information. One student we interviewed in this last study, actually, was putting up her survey. I mean, she was putting up her paper topic, which was, should cheerleading be a funded sport on this campus? Unusual topic. But was putting it up on her Facebook page to elicit responses and to do a small survey. This is different than when we were in school, probably, as well as kind of the erosion of pedagogical authority. It's not just the professor who has the answer or the take on a certain course. And then lastly, the whole information package has fundamentally changed, which is really an understatement. But this is my favorite quote, which is, looking around, actually, University of Washington, looking around the room, beautiful library there, and I said, do you use books? And a political theory student, smart as a whip, said, books? Do I use them? Not really. They're an antiquated interface. You have to look in the index way in the back, and then you have to go to the page and try to find it. Why would I use a book? Here at Harvard, another student said, when I have a research assignment, I read a book. And students in the focus group said, you do what? How much time do you have? So I'll end it there. Thank you.
So we have, thank you very much. You don't sit down.
Oh, okay.
Where do you think you're going? We have time for a few questions.
Oh, I thought you were going to promote your book.
No, I'm not. I'm not that type of person.
Okay.
So, questions?
Nothing. Well,
oh,
good.
Yes.
Thank you.
First, you have an answer why you were so popular with the kind of stuff you're providing. It makes sense that people are very, very interesting. These are extremely interesting questions that you're asking. So I wonder if along the lines of what you were finding, you noticed any difference in the way that faculty has changed assignments, given mm-hmm. this new world of, you know, cannot reuse mm-hmm. the previous assignment, cannot ask for something for which there is an answer already out there. Have we made the process of research a little more different or more difficult? Did you find any evidence?
I think one of the best assignments, and it's an interesting assignment that ties this together, we do interviews, and we did a smart talk with Andrea Lunsford that runs the PWR program in writing and research at Stanford, similar to XBOS here, actually. and she's kind of a leader in the field. She's written a book. It's used in a lot of comp classes across the country. And she said, the best assignment that I give is texts in conversation, is what it's called, texts in conversation. And she said, you have to go out and do research as a student, as you're writing on a big writing project. And this part of the assignment talks about how the different sources relate to one another, don't relate to one another, what you would include and what you wouldn't. Students say that's the most difficult assignment they have in the whole program at Stanford. That's a great example. I will just say one thing about instructors' handouts. I always think of this. I was quite close with the admin at St. Mary's College, and one day she said, hey, you want to see a bunch of syllabi and assignments? And I thought, God, how voyeuristic. You know, your colleagues, you can actually look at this. And I kind of went over and I thought, these stink. And then I thought about it and I thought, but mine, what is a good handout? And I thought, really, my handout was based on, in my syllabus, my favorite professor at Berkeley. I mean, there was never training when you're getting your PhD up. Well, you have the handout class, Allison, you're short, one class. Otherwise, we can give you a PhD. There really isn't training. You learn, you apprentice. And professors have apprenticed from other professors. And somebody actually, and we'll have this up in the next couple of weeks, at a community college, based on our findings, put together a workshop for, a librarian put together a workshop for bring your handout assignment. And let's critique it as a class. For continuing ed, for professors, instructors at the community college. And then let's talk about how you would change it. So, again, getting people that were interested looking at their syllabi, their handouts, their supportive material. But I think a lot of us as professors, we just really don't know. It's not necessarily anything that you share. And you don't think about sharing it. So that's an interesting question. Thanks, Takis, who's a fellow with me, actually. Yes.
So there's another dimension. I'm Harry Lewis. I teach computer science here, and I teach actually some other things as well. There's another dimension you haven't talked about, which is the change in the socioeconomic diversification of the student body, and it's something that I'm very, very conscious of here. The disparity as to whether students understand how to do research between the well-educated students and the not-so-well-educated but extremely ambitious students from crappy schools is enormous. And, you know, when you say, and, it just rang so true, the professor is saying, you know, they got into Harvard. They should know how to do research. Why should it be my job to tell them how to do footnotes? I think around here, the faculty, which is extremely progressive and is very glad that we're reaching out to the whole world and Kansas and inner cities and so on to try to bring students in from schools that Harvard never used to touch, actually have no interest in taking responsibility for teaching them what they need to know in order to do research once they get here.
Great story. When I did a focus group, actually, at Harvard, speaking a little bit out of turn, but it was such a great story. Really very, very bright woman she's like some double major. Parents were both physicians. This all came up during the focus group. And when she called me back to confirm, she was so articulate and so well-spoken that I said, no, it's not for faculty. It's for students. Because it was over the phone. She said, no, actually, I am a student. And she had gone to, it's kind of the other side of it. She had gone to this great prep school and had come here, and she said, oh my God, she's very funny. She said, oh my God, I thought I was going to fail Harvard after all of this, because I was in a class and they kept saying, go look at the LC is this. I thought, who's LC? And I couldn't figure it out. And then I realized my prep school used Dewey Decimal for organizing books. She said it wasn't until a librarian came in and did a session that I got it. And she said, and I was through most of my first semester here. Even small things like that. And that adjustment from moving to different environments. But it's true, the socioeconomic issues are huge. And somebody was talking to me last week about, well, wouldn't it be great to do a study? You're always doing all this work. Why don't you do a study about mid-performers and high-performers? Who are they? It's like, okay. A lot of it depends, too, where you went to high school. And I did go to a crappy high school. Sorry, I know it's on YouTube, but I think everybody would admit that it wasn't a great high school. And I remember being in college, and my friend went to a great high school, one of the best high schools in California, in Piedmont. And she, you know, they said, okay, you're going to read the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock. And I said, who? Did he write it? Did he? And she said, oh, I already wrote a paper on it in high school. And right there, that. Right, what you bring to the process and how much you're going to work.
We have time for one more question.
I'm a librarian at Boston University. Since the students aren't coming to the librarians, should the librarians go to the faculty, the instructors?
Well, I'll take you one step further. I'd love it if librarians went to students. You know, I'm always collecting stories, and I don't have a lot, about librarians leaving the reference desk. One study came from University of Illinois at Urbana from Lisa Hinchliffe, who was the president of ACRL and is kind of an advocate in this area. And she said, you know what I did? I looked at the reference desk. The library's packed. It's finals week. And I looked at the reference desk and the librarians. They are going through a couple of catalogs. I thought, this is insane. So we got on the PA system and said, are you having trouble with, you know, an assignment that you're working on? We'll be back. And she said, I knew the study area. I knew where they hung out. And we had a little triage section. You know, just set up a little table with triage and said, we can help you. And just took on a bunch of people in the line and provided quick answers. There's a solution, too. Yes, I think the model of reference, I'm not a librarian, this is not an easy thing to do, but needs to be looked at very closely. Much of the training, not everywhere, but much of the training, as we know, is resource-focused. It's like treating an alcoholic by saying, and we just got a new scotch in. It's kind of smoky, malty, peaty. But we have other scotches, too. So how can I help you today? It's not a model that necessarily works. One more, or?
No, I'm afraid we are out of time.
Okay.
So thank you so much.
Thanks.